This is the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks so much for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, or just go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. I used to tell people the Libertarian Party is the best of both sides. We take the economic freedoms from the right and the social freedoms from the left, says LP presidential nominee Jo Jorgensen. But she continues, I can't even say that anymore because Republicans aren't acting like Republicans and Democrats aren't acting like Democrats. In a recent NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll, the 63-year-old Clemson psychology lecturer is pulling 5% of the vote, which might cover the final spread between President Donald Trump and challenger Joe Biden. Jorgensen is on the ballot in every state, and she is preaching a message of self-empowerment and autonomy that she says attracts mostly independents and people who are getting politicized for the first time. Her constituents, she tells me, are people who believe that they should be able to make their own decisions, people who believe that they should have a right to decide their child's education, which healthcare they want and which healthcare they don't want, how to control the retirement dollars, and that they should be able to make a choice of whether or not they wear a mask. She is a mask wearer herself. In a wide-ranging conversation with me, Jorgensen, who was the LP's 1996 vice presidential candidate, explains why she thinks Gen Z is very live and let live, why the federal government should be half its current size, why she's very optimistic about the future, and how Alan Dershowitz, of all people, would make a great Supreme Court justice. Here is the Reason interview with Jo Jorgensen. Jo Jorgensen, thank you for talking to Reason.
Oh, so glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the obvious. Why are you running for president? What is your pitch to voters?
I am running for president because government is too big, too bossy, too nosy, too intrusive. But the worst part is they usually end up hurting the very people they're trying to help. So I tell people around the country that you know best what's best for you, not the politicians and bureaucrats in Washington.
Is that, that is a classic libertarian message. Ronald Reagan ripped that off with great success in the 1980s. Is it resonating with people?
It is. And I'd like to point out, one of the things I'd love to destroy is the myth of Reagan and small government. A lot of people don't realize that government grew year after year after year for 8 straight years with Reagan. And those closest to him said, well, you know, what do you expect? Congress didn't give him a balanced budget. You know, Congress didn't give him a budget that was smaller. But every single time they gave him a budget, he just, you know, smiled and signed it. Instead of sending it back and saying, nope, sharpen your pencil, this isn't good enough.
So do you agree? I guess it's Milton Friedman who talked about how, the ultimate measure of government ultimately is how much it spends at a given year, because eventually you got to pay for that either through tax increases, reductions in services, or some mixture or inflation. Is that how you think about, ultimately what's the measure of government?
Oh, absolutely. And people keep saying, oh, look at Donald Trump. We got tax cuts. Well, yeah, but he increased spending. So the bill is eventually going to come due. And I would suggest it's due already. And we're already past due, that we're still paying off our debt from, a decade ago. We need to get ahead of this. And if an American family was doing this, it would be bankrupt.
I think we may still be paying off the War of 1812, when you start looking.
Right.
And as somebody who knows how to, manipulate credit card debt, I know it took me years to pay off things that I never should have bought in the first place. We're now in an age, though, where the Congress and the president are the Republicans are in at loggerheads over. The Republicans only want to spend $300 billion on the next coronavirus relief bill. The Democrats want to spend $3.4 trillion. Is it quaint to be talking about how much government is spending?
Is it quaint? I would say it's life-threatening. I would say that we have to do something. We're so used to being the world's, quote-unquote superpower. We're so used to being able to call the shots, and we're so used to being able to just come out of whatever comes our way. We can't keep tempting fate like this. We have to get out in front of it.
When you say we can't keep tempting fate, can you kind of explain what is so bad about spending so much?
because eventually you have to pay it off. And we look around, we look at Germany, you know, back when they talk about carrying wheelbarrows full of Deutschmarks. So we look at Venezuela and we think, oh, well, that would never happen to us because we're America. Well, if we do the things that, you know, Germany in the past or Venezuela of the present did, then that will happen to us. So we're not immune to the laws of physics. We're not immune to gravity. Economics, there is a science to it. There is a system to it, and you can't just keep running away from it.
And so you see it as, if not hyperinflation, like we, you know, saw in Weimar Germany, right, or in contemporary Venezuela and some other countries, out of control spending reduces economic growth. Or what are the other considerations there?
Oh, yeah. Well, it hurts everything. It hurts just our very decision making. And I would say the biggest problem is that it hurts our freedom. And what I've been telling people is, you know what, even if we didn't have a deficit, even if we didn't have a debt, just government needs to be half the size it is anyway. And I've been going around saying we need to get rid of the federal income tax. We need to get rid of the IRS, because even if we had boatloads of money out back, still government should not be in, at least the federal government, not in education, healthcare, or retirement. And we should not have so many troops around the world. We would actually be safer. And you know, let me bring up having troops around the world. The irony here is that the job of the military is to keep us safe. The job of the military is to protect us. But what they're doing is they're making us less safe. All we have to do is look to 9/11. And again, we're spending money to keep us less safe. How ironic is that? And, you know, we hear people say, oh, isn't France great? They get 5-week vacations. Well, maybe if they paid for their own military and we didn't have to, maybe we could get our 5-week vacations too. Now, of course, I say that facetiously because we're in a bigger hole than that. But, yeah, you know, I go back to, why should taxpayers in Alabama, Wyoming, or wherever, why should they be paying for the military defense of countries around the world? We're in 160 different countries around the world. We need to come home. And as president, I would turn America into one giant Switzerland, armed and neutral.
I guess, and just to put a point on it, not only farmers in Alabama shouldn't be paying for defense, even though there are a lot of military bases in Alabama, so they're getting a lot of sweet government dollars, but people in New York and California shouldn't be paying farmers in Kansas, right, for agricultural subsidies.
Oh, absolutely. And when I say that government hurts the very people they try to help, that's what happens, is they see a problem, they try to fix it, and when they try to fix it, they create 10 new problems. You know, you can look at, for instance, college education. Government said, oh, it's so expensive for students to, you know, go to college. We'll just flood the market with money. We'll give them all these student loans, and then they can pay a loan, you know, borrow and then pay it back. And now look, the prices have gone up. And in fact, the price of education has gone up even more than, you know, the rest of the consumer goods. And then you look at healthcare. Government says, oh, let's go and try to help. And then healthcare costs explode. You look at the war on poverty and you look at charity. You know, our country was doing fine taking care of its poor, and the rate was going down, down, down for poverty rates. And then the government gets involved, they throw money at it, and the next thing you know, it slows down and eventually starts, you know, leveling off.
So what was your estimation of Ruth Bader Ginsburg as a Supreme Court justice from a libertarian perspective? She obviously, the Supreme Court justice died over the weekend. And this, I mean, is a good way to talk about kind of your larger governing strategy or what a libertarian president would do. You know, what'd you think of Ruth Bader Ginsburg as a justice? And, you know, who would you replace? Who would you name as her replacement?
Yeah, well, first of all, my condolences to her family. My mother just died a few weeks ago, so I can appreciate, you know, what her family's going through. And I don't want to speak too ill of the recently dead, of course, but intellectual rigor is one phrase I would use with her. However, I differ with her in how we should treat the Constitution. I'm not sure she ever used the term living Constitution, but if you look at her rulings and if you look at the things she voted for, it appears as though she believed in a living Constitution, as opposed to, I see the Constitution as a contract, as something that was written and that we need to follow. And I realized that my number one pick is perhaps a little older than the ideal pick, but I would like to see somebody like Alan Dershowitz, because we need somebody, first of all, who understands, first of all, who's read the Constitution, which he obviously has, and he knows the Constitution very well. But something that I've really admired about him is he called himself a proud Hillary supporter. And by the way, he used the term proud. And even before he was on Trump's defense team, he was out there on TV saying, you know what, this is not the way the Constitution works. This is not the way our government works. We don't start with a person and then go in search of a crime. The way our country works is we start with a crime and then we look at who did it. So the fact that he can call himself a proud Hillary supporter while at the same time saying Trump should not be impeached, I think that shows a level of impartiality that we just don't see these days. Right now, everything we see is, you know, orange man bad, or we got to get the Democrats out there. We don't see anybody saying, talking civilly really to both sides. And I think that's what we need in a Supreme Court justice.
Well, and certainly he would keep the controversy level high, right? Given all of the intersection of his charges and countercharges related to Jeffrey Epstein and a number of related issues. Let's talk about, Donald Trump and Joe Biden. In a recent NPR NewsHour Marist College poll, you polled 5% when they actually deigned to list the four candidates who are in enough states to win 270 electoral votes. So it's, you know, Trump, Biden, Jorgensen as a Libertarian, then Howie Hawkins. And I guess everybody wishes he was Howard Hughes, right?
Yeah.
To pay for his own campaign. But Howie Hawkins of the Green Party. The four of you are the only people who could be elected, you know, no matter what, you know, because you're in enough states. But let's talk about Joe Biden and Donald Trump. What are the two or three biggest failures of the Trump presidency? Not of Trump as a businessman, right, or, you know, as a human being,
yeah,
as a game show or reality show host, but as a president. You look at the past 4 years, what makes you convinced that he should definitely not be given a second term?
Well, the fact that he didn't act like an outsider. He came in saying, I'm a businessman. I know how to balance a budget. I know how to cut spending. And he didn't do that. And not only did he not cut spending, he increased spending. Now we've got a bigger deficit, bigger debt. So I would say that is the number one thing, because it all boils, you know, whether you're talking education, healthcare, retirement, it all boils down to, are you in control of your dollars, or is the government taking your money and basically not, you know, it'd be one thing. My campaign manager has often said, you know, I wouldn't mind if they taxed me and then just burned those campaign dollars. But the fact that they use them against me, that's what makes it even worse. So I would say the fact that he's using it to increase the size of government. And the second thing I would say is that he didn't bring the troops home as he promised. And I remember a few weeks ago, I was so happy to hear he was bringing the troops out of Germany. Yay, he's finally starting as promised. It's 4 years late, but he's finally starting as promised. And then he drops them off in Poland. I thought, no, you need to keep coming. You know, America is a few more thousand miles that way. So we got to get the troops home.
What do you think of his coronavirus response, or that of the, you know, I guess more broadly of the federal government? But, you know, Trump's handling of the coronavirus, is he generally good, or should he be, put out in a lockdown for good? Because
I would say he's done everything wrong. Now, granted, I know a lot of Republicans are saying, well, but Joe Biden wants to keep us in masks outside for another 3 months. Okay, right. Just because somebody would do something worse, it doesn't mean that what Trump did was great. Two major mistakes. The first thing he did is he did not get rid of the FDA obstacles. There were literally dozens of testing kits that we could have been using to get ahead of the virus, and both both FDA and the CDC blocked them. Originally, the FDA only approved two of them. Meanwhile, we've got Southeast Asia, who's getting ahead of the curve. They were using all the testing kits that we couldn't, so they knew who could stay home or who needed to stay home and who could go out and work, whereas we're all under house arrest. We don't know who needs to stay home and who can go out there because we don't have any testing kits. And there are still blockades to testing kits. In fact, a couple of weeks ago, my director of communications, just to see if it was still true, went out there, tried to order testing kits, and she was told, nope, we can't sell these testing kits in either US or Canada. We can sell them, you know, in other parts of the world. So they're still being blocked. And the second thing is he got on stage, and I noticed that you broadened your question to the federal government, but speaking directly to Trump, he stood there on stage with Dr. Fauci and said, if you don't have symptoms, you don't need to get tested. And yet at that very moment, the medical experts were saying that over half the people with the virus showed no symptoms at all. Well, that's when you need to get it. That's when you need to get tested. Because otherwise you could have no symptoms, have the virus and be out there infecting people. And I realize you're not as infectious, but still you could be infecting people. And in the beginning, we didn't know enough about the virus. We didn't know if you had symptoms, were you more infectious than those without. But the point is you shouldn't be sitting there saying about a disease in which, you know, which many are asymptomatic. You shouldn't say don't get tested if you don't have symptoms. That's ridiculous.
Let's talk about Joe Biden. This is a guy who has spent nearly 50 years in office and often wielding immense power either in the U.S. Senate or as vice president for 8 years under Barack Obama. What are your two or three biggest problems with Joe Biden?
You know, I have one big conceptual problem. And when we were in school, we all learned, oh, citizen, statesman, politician. And, you know, we memorized it for a test and we never really thought about what it meant. And even libertarians sometimes will throw that word around without really thinking about what it means. What it means is you go to Washington for a couple of months, you pass laws, and then you go home and live under those laws for the rest of the year, for the majority of the year. My biggest problem with Joe Biden is that he has been passing laws for 47 years and hasn't had to live under a single one of them, because what we have in Washington right now is Animal Farm. We've got a system in which some are more equal than others. And so he doesn't even feel the pain of his laws. And so to have somebody go into Washington, not even knowing what it's like to live as a citizen under these laws, is just the wrong person.
Do you think, you know, Joe Biden has lately changed his career-long tune, and in this he's been joined by Kamala Harris, his vice presidential pick, but Joe Biden over the course of his career was very, very pro-prosecution in general. He helped create the, you know, kind of prison industrial complex in America. He constantly was pushing and backing laws that would incarcerate more people, would intensify sentences for people, would get rid of things like parole in the federal system. On the drug war front, he helped create the Office of Drug War, Drug Czar. He has been even to this day, he's kind of squirrely on legalizing marijuana, much less other types of drugs. Do you buy the new Joe Biden when he says, you know what, like I made a mistake, or, you know, kind of I made a mistake, and, you know, going forward, I'm going to try to de-intensify and, you know, reduce the level of, you know, kind of police and law enforcement in people's everyday life?
No, I don't buy the new Joe Biden. And this is what I really hate about politics that we have right now, is that what they do is they focus group out, you know, their policies, and they see, do they want it, do they not want it? And back in the 90s, crime had been high for a while. And so people wanted to hear him say, I'm tough on crime. So he said, I'm tough on crime. And now they want to hear something else. So he's something else. You know, he doesn't have a rudder. He doesn't have something that's guiding him. And I would say that's true not only about Biden, but pretty much any Democrat out there. And one thing that I've pointed out, and young people are shocked to hear, is that both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama were against gay marriage just back in 2012. That was only 8 years ago that they said gay marriage should be illegal. And so what we have is we have not only Joe Biden, but the whole group of Democrats who just kind of, go like this, see which way the wind is going, and then that's how they make their policy, as opposed to sticking up for the individual. And what's really sad is that the Democratic Party, decades ago when I was growing up in the 60s, I remember, hearing that the Democratic Party, they were anti-war, they wanted peace around the world, they wanted free speech, they were on the side of the individual, they were on the side of, people of color and gays and so forth. They are none of that. If they ever were, they certainly aren't now. And I would say, just they weren't even back then, that was just a way to get that was a means to their end.
Do you go back a little bit, does the federal response, and this includes Trump and it includes the Democrats and Republicans in Congress as well as in state houses around the country, do you think the kind of political class response to coronavirus, to COVID-19, does that exemplify the libertarian critique of government?
Could you expand on that?
What I mean by that is that, should we be using, the way that government at the, state, local, and federal level, and obviously there are differences in how they responded, but does it kind of prove the point of what libertarians or members of the Libertarian Party say about the wisdom and efficacy and effectiveness of government?
Well, yeah, of course. And what we see right now, we see Trump saying, nope, stay home. And then all of the governors take his lead. They lock down their states. And then he's saying, open them up. And then the Republicans have such a short memory that they forget that he's the one that told them all to shut down anyway. And even though he perhaps didn't have the authority to shut down the state, certainly has a bully pulpit as president. And the governors, of course, listen to him. So, but, that's still a broader thing that the libertarians have been trying. One of the biggest messages, there are so many underlying messages that libertarians have been trying to bring about. And one of them is the fallacy that if the federal government doesn't do it, or if government in general doesn't do it, it won't get done. And there's this kind of underlying feeling that if the government didn't tell us to wear masks, we wouldn't wear masks. Or if the government didn't tell us to stay home when we're sick, we wouldn't stay home. And that's not the case at all. And I just point to Walmart and say, here we have Walmart saying you're not shopping. It doesn't matter what the laws are. You're not shopping in our store unless you're wearing a mask. Well, how about having, and I think you mentioned Milton Friedman earlier, maybe, but Milton Friedman's vote with your feet, vote with your dollars, where if you want to wear a mask, great, you shop at Walmart. If you don't want to wear a mask, then go to a different store that doesn't require you to wear a mask. Instead of we all go to the ballot box and vote and come up with one system, which half the people are going to hate. How about we each vote every day? We each vote every day what we want. So if you think masks are a good idea, then go to Walmart. And just the fact that there are so many private companies out there who are catering to people, wearing masks, that shows that just because, that it would get done without the government. And also I'd like to point out, generally, if you look at people themselves, because some people might say, oh, so you think the corporations then should lead the way? Well, no, the corporations are actually trying to earn people's dollars, so they're following the lead of the people. And back in the late spring, there was a poll asking people, do you think we're opening up too early? Because some of the states were starting to open up that had shut down early. And something like 70% of the people said, yes, we're opening up too early. So again, it's not that we're all a bunch of dummies and we have to wait to be told what to do by government. We are adults and we don't need to have people in Washington being our mom and our dad.
A recent NPR NewsHour Marist College poll puts you at 5% in a four-way race. What sorts of voters are attracted to your message and to the Libertarian Party more broadly?
Well, in general, unlike the myths that are out there that we draw from the right, we actually bring voters from both the Democrats and Republicans pretty equally overall. Now, this particular race, I don't have numbers on, but overall, we bring from both Democrats and Republicans. But most of our voters come from either independents or people who had never voted before. And so that's why, you know, and by the way, that's how Trump got to where he is. And also, it's why the polls were all wrong, because the polls weren't looking at people who had never voted or who hadn't voted in a while. And that's why I've been telling people who haven't voted in a while, who, you know, now that they've dusted off their voter registration card or now that they've got a new one, hey, this time vote for what you really want, which is a true outsider. And even though Donald Trump wasn't a politician, he was still part of the system. And I would say if you really want an outsider to defend your rights, that the Libertarian Party is the only answer.
Do you think, what is the function of the Libertarian Party or a vote for a Libertarian for president? You're not going to win the presidency. You know, I don't believe that Libertarian or third party candidates are spoilers. I don't believe that any, you know, one of the major parties has a claim to anybody's vote. So if you vote for a third party, you're somehow denying a real candidate a chance, anything like that. But, you know, a lot of people would say, why should I vote for somebody who has no chance of winning? What's the essence of voting libertarian? What does one accomplish in your mind by doing that?
Well, first of all, what's frustrating is polls have shown that there are about 40 million libertarian-leaning people. So if everybody voted for what they truly wanted, I would win. And I'd like to quote Ed Clark, who was our 1980 presidential candidate, who, you know, when he was asked, could he win? He said, you know, if I could sit around the kitchen table of every American family in this country, I would win by a landslide. And that's how I feel, that my vision of America is the America that people want, if I could just reach them. Unfortunately, it is difficult getting through the media. You mentioned that I was in that poll. If I had been in polls all along, the numbers would be much higher, because that's the way it works, is once your name recognition gets out there, then it just goes up. So what I would tell people right now is, you know, first of all, it's not too late. I'm not in this just to get the consolation prize. And by the way, my degree is in industrial organizational psychology, and I realize that impossible goals can be motivating. So I still have the goal of winning. I'm not going to give up until the last night. I am going to work hard for people's votes. But if you're convinced I can't win, I would just ask, you know, again, if you voted for Trump, do you like what he's given you? If you don't want bigger government, if you don't like the fact that the debt and deficit are bigger, why would you vote for more of that? If you voted for him because he's an outsider, then vote for me to send a message that, hey, you're not, you know, this isn't what I voted for. This is what I want. I wanted you to be an outsider, so start acting like one. And I'm going to vote for another outsider until you start acting like one. And particularly people in the solidly red, solidly blue states. You know, South Carolina, where I'm at, we are solidly red. We were one of only six states to carry Bob Dole in 1996. So I would say, wow, if you're in the South,
you got a lot to, you know, that might rival being the first state to secede from the Union. Yes. as a problem.
You're absolutely right. So I would say if you're in a solidly red state like I'm in, if you don't like what Donald Trump has been doing, if you don't like the bigger government he's given you, then voting for him is a wasted vote. And to Democrats, especially Democrats in California and New York, I would say that, you know, don't vote for Joe Biden if you want more war, if you want more of your rights taken away, if you think that you have a right to have access to marijuana. A vote for him is a wasted vote because he's not going to change that. Vote for what you really want.
When you say the kind of basic libertarian message, you said there are 40 million Americans, you know, who are more or less libertarian. How are you defining libertarian? What is that libertarian that you're pitching towards?
Oh, people who believe that they should be able to make their own decisions. people who believe that they should have a right to decide their child's education. They have a right to decide which healthcare they want and which healthcare they don't want, that they should be able to control their retirement dollars, and that they should be able to make a choice of whether or not they wear a mask. Just the people who aren't saying, you know what, I want government to decide every day how I should live my life. You know, that would be the opposite of libertarian.
You know, the old political coalitions that you and I hesitate to ask a woman her age while I'm recording, how old are you?
Well, yeah, it's on Wikipedia. I'm 63.
Okay, so I'm 57. So we're, you know, basically we grew up in the same same time zone, the same historical period back when mastodons and saber-toothed tigers were still walking the earth. You know, the old political coalitions that we grew up with are fraying. I mean, what it meant to be a Republican and a Democrat, you know, up through, you know, I don't know, through the end of the Cold War, through the end of the 20th century, you know, the conditions that they were born out of don't really exist anymore. And you know, voters seem increasingly dissatisfied with both options. Matt Welch and I, my recent colleague, wrote a book about, you know, independent voters. And that was the starting point. And in fact, something like 41-42% of Americans call themselves independent. Political identification with either the Republicans or the Democrats is at or near historic lows. And there's no reason to believe that's going to change. What I want to ask, though, is a little bit different because, you know, taking that as a backdrop, the Libertarian Party and the Libertarian movement more broadly, and I don't believe I've ever registered as a Libertarian. If I have, it hasn't been in many years. And since I joined Reason 25, 26, 27 years ago, Libertarians have been mostly male, mostly wealthy, mostly white. Do you agree with that? And is that a problem, or what needs to change about that?
I don't have the most recent statistics. That might be more a question for the national chair to answer. Okay. However, I can say that we have been attracting a lot of women to the movement. Mm-hmm. And when I go to these rallies, I do see a lot of women. Now, and I hate to get into gender politics, but I will say that when I was running for the nomination during the primary, I had a lot of libertarians come up to me and say, you know, I mean, well, like one example, I got an email from a pretty high ranking libertarian saying that he's been a member of the party for 20 years, big party guy, held office, that kind of stuff. But his wife only grudgingly went along. You know, she was small L libertarian, but grudgingly went along. And after seeing me in one of the conventions, one of the state conventions, she joined the party. And so I've had a lot of husbands tell me that, yes, my wife finally joined the party. And it's sad that it took me to do that. But I don't think it's because I am a woman. I don't think they're saying, oh, wow, there is a woman. I think it's because I am sending a message, a practical message that, hey, we need to talk to voters about what they care about. We can't go around with the early, you know, 1970s, 1980s message of it's my body, it's my money, I should have control over that. We've got to talk like salespeople. We've got to go out and tell the American voter what we can do for the American voter. And where I thought you were headed with this question, you know, you started off talking about, you know, how, you know, back in the, when the mastodons were ruling the earth, you know, what, you know, the libertarian focus. Yeah, when I first joined the party, I used to tell people, well, the Libertarian Party is the best of both sides. We take the economic freedoms from the right and the democratic freedoms or the social freedoms from the left. I can't even say that anymore because Republicans aren't acting like Republicans. Democrats aren't acting like Democrats. And I reread David Berglund's book last year and something hit me that I guess, you know, hadn't made a mark on me before, where he said, yes, sure, we share some views with Democrats and some views with Republicans, but maybe it's just coincidence that we do. Maybe the reason that we believe that, you know, we should be able to own guns and the Republicans do as well, maybe it's for different reasons and we just happen to fall on the same side. So I don't go around with that older message of saying, yes, we take the best of both sides, because now we really have devolved down to where we've got a red team and a blue team. And in fact, it's kind of been funny watching this whole maybe funny is the wrong word, but you know,
I think the word you were looking for is heartbreaking.
Yes.
Depressing, yes. Disturbing.
Much better word. Thank you, Nick. You know, the Supreme Court justice, in fact, I heard on a Republican talk show playing all the Democrats from the last time around mm-hmm. when they were saying how, yes, Obama should, you know, Obama has the right, of course, to name the Supreme Court justice, right? But here's what the person on the right didn't do, what the talk show host on the right didn't do, didn't play all of the Republicans saying, no, you shouldn't choose somebody. Right. So it's basically the red team and the blue team. They're not going by a specific philosophy. It's just whatever context you put them in. And it's really funny how we get, you know, Nancy Pelosi being pro-war if it goes against Donald Trump. So it's not right. even, okay, this is our core belief. These are our core beliefs. Now it's, well, Trump wants this. We want the opposite. It heartbreaking and hilarious at the same time.
Why did that happen? You know, if nothing else, I mean, and obviously political parties change their core ideology all the time. I think you and I might remember this from grammar school in the 19th century, but there's a famous political cartoon talking about old wine and new bottles. And it was just somebody pouring, you know, something into a Republican bottle in a Democratic Party. Ideological shifts happen. But we have gotten to a point where not only are we super polarized, but the parties do not seem to be particularly coherent. You know, what's your rationale? Why do you think that happened?
Well, but you just said a key term there, ideological shifts. And I would suggest that there is no ideology left with them. It's mm-hmm. not like it's not like the Democrats saying, well, we used to not be for the individual. That's why we're against gay marriage. And now let's be more for the individual. No, it's, you know, again, let's see which way the wind is blowing. You had to have known in 2012 that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton personally thought that gays should be able to marry. I have no doubt about that. But politically, they had to pretend they believed in the opposite because they wanted to get votes. Because now what it's come down to is it's you know, ideology out the window. It's we want votes, we want power, we want to be the ruling class. It's Animal Farm all over again.
So to go back to this question of broadening the appeal of the libertarian movement, it's interesting and it's heartening to hear that, you know, women are interested in your candidacy. What is it if, I mean, because you believe that individuals have a right to kind of, you know, we own our bodies and we're able to do with them what we want. And that has obviously implications for everybody, male and female. But in an American context, particularly coming out of the 70s, that meant a lot about sexual freedom. It meant reproductive autonomy and things like that. What are the other things that libertarians should be saying that will attract women? Well, how do you convince women who may have historically or sociologically been kind of put off by the libertarian message? What's in libertarianism for them?
Well, but let me back up. You said that we own our bodies. What other mm-hmm. messages do we want to put out there? I don't put out that message. And mm-hmm. one thing that I have never done on the campaign trail is talked about self-ownership and government dystopia and all the usual libertarian talking points of the past. You know, that's language of the 1970s and 80s, because yes, we do own our bodies, but that's not what voters care about. So mm-hmm. I don't even talk about that. For instance, when it comes to drugs, I explain to people how, you know, rather than saying it's my body, I should be able to smoke marijuana, I go around and I say, you know what, I've never used drugs. Actually, I correct that. Mm-hmm. Bourbon is my drug of choice, and I have a graduate certificate in drug and addiction studies, so I know that mm-hmm. bourbon, that alcohol is a drug. But I don't go out and I don't say, hey, I should be able to smoke or use whatever drug I want. want. I go out and I say, hey, wouldn't you like safer streets? Hey, wouldn't you like to have schools in which your kids don't have drug pushers going after them? And I ask them, when's the last time you ever heard of a liquor store owner trying to push gin on high school students in the hallways? So, you know, sending a more practical message, because to quote somebody else, liberty is what works and liberty is right. And so what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to focus on the liberty works message. We all know that liberty is right. However, how can we sell the benefits? How can we show the American people that this is what works? Because so many of them out there are very pragmatic and they're living their lives. They don't care about politics. It's not like they're, you know, Sunday football to them. They don't even take notice of, you know, who's running for president until a couple months before the elections when all the talk comes up.
So what is the appeal of that message that you were sending? Well, you know, that liberty is right and liberty is what works, but also, you know, do you want good schools? Do you want safe streets? How does that attract black voters? Do you find it, you know, we're in a front, you know, in 2020, you know, the major stories really are coronavirus and or more specifically, the lockdown that has cratered the economy, and then the George Floyd protests and the rise of Black Lives Matter and a national conversation about police reform, criminal justice reform, things that libertarians have been talking about literally since, you know, I know at Reason, which was founded in 1968 and the Libertarian Party in 1971, literally since the conception of the modern libertarian movement. Are you finding that blacks are interested in what you're talking about?
Absolutely. And in fact, I was criticized for meeting with some Black Lives Matter leaders. And I'd like to point out that, first of all, yes, there is the Marxist headquarters. Of course, libertarianism is the opposite of Marxism. Just look at the Nolan chart. However, I was speaking with, and granted, there was a typo that was capitalized, it shouldn't have been, but I was speaking with local leaders who had nothing to do with the national movement. And I sat down with a local Black Lives Matters leader who had been in prison and who was, now a felon, and he was a preacher. And I told him how the rest of the story for Rosa Parks. I said, I know you know the story of Rosa Parks, heroic black woman refused to sit in the back of the bus. Did you know that that was a government-run, government-owned bus? And he said, no, I didn't. And I said, well, think about it. At the time, something like 60% of the riders were blacks. Now, look at today with Uber in the free market. What if Uber did that to the majority, to the best 60% of their customers? It would go out of business as well. It should. And, you know, I could see the wheels clicking. And I said, you know, we agree on so many things that, you know, qualified immunity, ending no-knock laws, the racist war on drugs. What we need to do is we need to look at what the solution is. And unfortunately, the home office basically is Marxist, and they're turning to bigger government. I would suggest that big government caused it. And since he, you know, had been in prison, I said, and look, libertarians believe that you have the right to defend yourself. Just because you were in jail doesn't mean that you have your constitutional rights taken away. And, you know, if you're too dangerous to have a gun, then you should still be in prison. If you've done your time and now you're out of prison, you have the right to self-defense. You have the right to own a gun. And he was hearing many of these things for the first time and was actually very interested. And, you know, this is like, we get back to Ed Clark. You know, if we could sit down around somebody's kitchen table and have a conversation, we could explain how liberty works and liberty is right and how this gets us all to where we want to be. Well, all except for people like Nancy Pelosi. You know, she's got right what she wants.
What about young people? You know, you mentioned earlier that, we need to, you know, the government should be cut in half in terms of, you know, its size, scope and spending, which You know, and it's funny to think about now. And by funny, I mean, like, yes, you meant, you know, I mean, heartbreaking, that if we cut the government spending in half now in real terms, we'd be back to, you know, kind of where it was during the last couple of years of Bill Clinton. We're not talking about going back to, you know, the Pleistocene or something like that. But young people do not seem to be moved necessarily by the idea that the government is spending too much money, that the government is taxing, you know, taxing too much. They are particularly interested, you know, they seem to be interested in having the government relieve them of student loan debt. They want more spending done to combat climate change. What are your libertarian messages to young people? And I realize that's an overly broad group, but, you know, as long as we're talking about large voting blocks.
Well, first of all, I wonder if those aren't the views of the vocal young people. Jean Twenge wrote a great book called iGen. She's a social psychologist. And she said it's really amazing watching what's going on today, because usually when you follow trends, they go like very slowly up or very slowly down. But she said the way it is right now with the current generation, which she calls iGen. We haven't settled on a name for Gen Z yet, like we did with Gen Y, with millennials. And she said it goes up, 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 and then straight up or down. Mm-hmm. And she said that actually, and by the way, she does not sound very libertarian to me. And most social psychologists, like 92% of them, are off the charts liberal anyway. But she actually points out that according to her research, many in this young generation are naturally libertarian. They look at it, they go, well, of course it makes sense. Why shouldn't you be able to own a gun? But of course it makes sense. Why shouldn't two people the same sex get married? You know, they look at it and they say, well, of course that would be the fair way to do it. And why, you know, yeah, if you can drink red wine, why can't you smoke marijuana? So that overall, they have a very libertarian underpinning as far as their kind of live and let live libertarian philosophy. So that's excellent news, because we haven't had that in the past. In the past, we've had, you know, no, you can't own that gun, or no, you can't own that particular drug. So from that standpoint, they've got a very libertarian philosophy. I'm going to have to go back to her book and see what her polls say about, you know, if they did any particularly with the size of government. But still, I think that they do have a sense of fairness in that, you know, the young people that I've been asking, hey, you know, when you have a college degree, you make on average $1 million more of your lifetime. Do you think that truck drivers and electricians and cashiers should be paying for the education of doctors and bankers and lawyers? And a lot of times the answer is no. So,
but well, do they also believe, and, you know, I know some libertarians, and I'm thinking of people like the political scientist and economist Michael Munger at Duke, who talk about fairness, and this, the reason I bring it up is it seems to me to capture something about Gen Z. There's also, you know, should the government help people, particularly at the lower end of the economic distribution, or who don't have as many options growing up, should it help them have more options so that they can participate more fully in government? And this is a kind of libertarian spin on a social welfare state. How do you feel about something like that?
Well, they get more options with the free market, because it's the government who's passing rules and, you know, passing laws and making it, who get rid of the ability of people on the low end to get a step up, whether it's minimum wage laws, whether it's licensing laws, whether it's, you know, just the past redlining and school districts the way that they've put stuff in the past. So I would suggest in a free market, it'd be much easier to get going. And even looking at free market charity versus government charity, the free market can do a much better job than the government.
Why don't you tell me your conversion experience? You obviously, you have been, not only are you the first female nominee for the Libertarian Party for president, and I guess in, you know, following Hillary Clinton, you're the, you know, the second, you know, large party presidential candidate. What, in 1996, you were the vice presidential candidate on a ticket with Harry Brown. What was your conversion experience? How did you come to libertarianism?
Well, I was never converted. I started out that way. Mm-hmm. I think reading Animal Farm in fifth grade, whenever it was that we read it, I think that's what did it. And I've had some reporters ask me, so I guess what, you were student body president or you ran for student council, and the hairs on the back of my neck bristle. It's like, in high school, I hated the idea that an elite few got to make rules for the rest of us. I thought, well, how is that fair? And I immediately thought to Animal Farm, you know, where some are more equal than others. I never ran for student council or student body president. And I hated that we even had one. And then I was in my final year of college when I heard about the Libertarian Party, and I thought, oh my gosh, there's somebody else who believes what I believe in. So it was ready made. And so I voted. The first presidential election I ever voted in was 1980, and I voted for Ed Clark. So I didn't really come from the left or the right. However, I do remember one thing, and I came from a very small town. I grew up literally in the cornfields of northern Illinois. We had one stoplight, and I used to literally cut through a cornfield to get to school in the morning. And in high school, our valedictorian, whose dad was some high muckety-muck in the, you know, school superintendent or something, she gave this speech that was so radical and so controversial that everybody in the small town talked about it. And I do remember, and I attended the graduation. I was a freshman, but I was in the band, so I was there attending the graduation. And I remember one line that she said was, isn't it hypocritical that people sit there with their martinis telling young people they can't smoke marijuana? And I thought, by golly, she's right. And now I was one of the few in the 70s, high school, I was, 70s was basically my high school and college, who never even tried marijuana. But that just seems so unfair to me. And I thought, you know, she's right. That's not fair. Mm-hmm. So I, from a very young age, I think I had a sense of that's not fair. And, you know, I think that's really what draws a lot of libertarians, what drew a lot of libertarians originally to the party, of it's that that's not fair, what gives them the right, and it's my body kind of thing. And that's why I say we have to expand to where we show that not only is it not fair, but this is also practically the best way to run our lives.
Are you optimistic or pessimistic about the future? What if anything, you know, over the, you know, how do you feel about the next 4 years or the next 8 years? And how do you feel about the longer term future? What, you know, are you optimistic or pessimistic?
Yeah, I'm very optimistic. First of all, I'm optimistic by nature, but I got to admit, I was getting a little down, especially with the government's lockdown of the coronavirus. But what really started lifting my spirits was seeing those people in Michigan going to the state house protesting. Hmm. And I thought, wow, we still have some American individualism left. We still have some of that, you know, ruggedness where, you know, we're Americans and we're not going to take it anymore. And watching the Dallas hairdresser say, no, I'm not going to shut down, or that New Jersey barber, watching people around the country say, no, this is wrong. And I thought, wow, the Americans haven't turned into just sheep where we're all going to sit home and take it because the government tells us to. So I am.
Do you
so
feel that way about the peaceful protests against police violence?
What about them?
Do you feel similarly about peaceful protests against police violence?
I guess that's, yes, that would be another example of people saying we're not going to take it. Somehow people thought that no-knock raids were okay, qualified immunity was okay, and now people are saying, you know what, that's not okay. So people are looking for justice, and I'm going to say justice, period. I hate it when people put a word in front of justice. If you put a word in front of justice and you start qualifying it, now it's no longer justice. Justice is justice, period.
Could you speak as a kind of final topic to discuss? You are a lecturer at Clemson University in industrial psychology. How does your work, your research and your teaching, how does that intersect with your ideological or political beliefs?
Well, unlike the liberals, I don't bring my politics into the classroom. I realize that students and their parents are paying tuition dollars and they're here to they are there to hear about psychology, and psychology is a science. I would say my only it's really not pushing my agenda. It's just trying to keep what should be there. So, for instance, psychology is a science. And more and more and more, if you look at the textbooks, textbooks are becoming politicized. They talk about social policy. They say, well, we've discovered such and such in psychology, therefore we need to have this law. And I was appalled when my personal psychology, social psychology textbook, the third edition, they started talking about gun laws. I'm like, no, this is not psychology. Psychology is not policy, it's science. And what I have done on a smaller scale is, for instance, and let me mention my social psychology book, the fourth, and so I didn't actually go to the third edition, and then the fourth edition, they took that part out, so that was good. But the first edition of my social psychology book, they used a statistic that said that, and talking about tragedy of the commons, how in the Soviet Union, when they were starving, that the government said, okay, you can own your plot of land, and 3% of the farmland in the Soviet Union produced 30% of the food. And I thought, wow, that's a great statistic. And I noticed it was gone from the second edition and every edition after that, probably because all of the liberal social psychologists didn't like that. But I have continued to use that. So if I can legitimately use, you know, psychological science, I do. But again, I do not take liberties with other people's tuition like the liberals do.
In 2016, Gary Johnson, the presidential nominee for the Libertarian Party, got about 3.3% of the popular vote. He got over 4 million votes. Prediction, you know, how will you fare in relation to that? And do you think you will more than cover the spread between Donald Trump and Joe Biden?
Well, it's hard to tell. And it's hard to tell because we don't know how much media we're going to get. By now, Gary Johnson had been in several polls. And I guess they learned their lesson. As you probably know, Johnson got up to like 13.6% of the vote. He almost got to 15%. So I guess they learned their lesson and they're not putting me in the polls. So I have a disadvantage. I would like to beat his numbers. We're certainly going to try. I certainly hope to beat his numbers the first time he ran because, of course, name recognition, the second time you run, your name's already out there, so that's going to help. So I definitely want to beat his first election. We're going to try to beat the second one as well. We'll see.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there. We've been talking with Jo Jorgensen. She is the She's the former vice presidential nominee for the Libertarian Party. And of course, she is heading the ticket for the 2020 election for the Libertarian Party. Jo Jorgensen, thank you for talking to Reason.
Oh, thank you. And by the way, I've slipped into that as well, so I can't fault Joe Biden either. So yes, this time it is the top of the ticket. So thanks
it
for
is,
having me.
It is good at a young, spry 63. You are much, much younger than either Joe Biden or Donald Trump. So you've got that going for you. This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, at Google, at Spotify, at Stitcher, at SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts. Or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Thanks for listening.